Jones.
Good morning. What I thought I would do by way of introduction is take you through a handful of amendments to my section 42A report, just all very minor things, but I thought it might be useful to run through them just so your copies are accurate. Would you like to do that?
That's so worthwhile.
Okay, so page, as I say, they're all very minor points. Page 22. The original section 42A report. Just half a dozen.
Yep.
Correction we've got to make. Page 22, in respect of the first paragraph on that page, which is just 12.9b, just wanting to change the second on the second line, it says endangered vegetation. That should say at risk vegetation.
Oh, is there a paragraph number?
12.9. Starts on the other page.
Oh, sorry.
No, 22. It's subsection B, second line. This is endangered vegetation, just particularly after the ecology discussion this morning. That should say at risk, you know what I'm talking about there in terms of using the proper terminology. Also, in terms of those footnotes.
So rather than endangered, you mean?
Yes, it's those at risk species that, that Ms. Palmer and Dr. Bramley both discussed in a similar way. The footnote 13 down the bottom of that page should be paragraphs 17 and 22 of her evidence dated the 19th of July. And similarly, the footnote on page 23 should read paragraph 55 of the evidence 19 July.
19 July.
Page 24. Paragraph 15.1, and just a very minor point, just the second to last line should read, the requested is not attempt to quantify the contribution that will be made to the economy during the construction phase. There's no criticism there at all by my part, it's just to clarify that's what I was making the comment there. Also on that page, paragraph 14.1, just above there, Ms. Semple was correct. That was an error in my reporting, that there was, where it says a large number of submitters raised this issue. There were actually three submitters that raised that issue, and I did double check all the other comments along those lines, and the others were all accurate as far as I'm concerned. But that one was three submitters from my looking through the submissions. And page 29, paragraph 21.1, and that should certainly read, taking into account the submissions, the advice of council's experts, so all the council's experts rather than Ms. Galavazzi. And wherever I've said the request report, and you don't need to make this change, but you know, when I've said that I have taken into account submissions, council's advice, council experts, the request report by an associated section 32, I mean, obviously, I also took into account all the material that was included within that section 32 report, being the requester's various assessments and so on.
Well, I think it's probably easier if you just read through it, since we haven't had a chance to pre-read it.
Introduction. This supplementary evidence serves three purposes: to respond to various points raised by the panel during the hearing, to respond to various points raised by legal submissions and other experts, and to respond to the amended proposal as outlined in Ms. Semple's legal submissions. I've made those minor corrections to the Section 42A report, taking you through those. So in response to points raised by the panel, and the purpose of drafting this up is really just to try and be as helpful as possible rather than, you know, take questions today that potentially have a similar vein to those that you've asked, Ms. Taylor. So this section deals with the reasoning behind the open space zone, anything I can offer in that respect, and anything I can offer in terms of the Opera Borough's nature of the ODP provision that we've got there. So the reasoning behind the open space zone, so page 15 of the decision on variation 25, which we've now got a copy of, states the following under the consideration heading. I won't read it all out, but just highlight that it talks about the fact that it rezones these more sensitive areas, open space zone, which provides a far greater protection than the rural general zone. And it alerts you to the Section 32 report, which identifies in the cost-benefit analysis that the retaining rural general zone is not the most appropriate option. So that's a flag for you to look at that, to look at the reasons why perhaps. That comment aligns with my recollection at the time. Just at the time I was the planning manager at the council in charge of the process. That comment aligns with my recollection at the time, which was that rural general zoning did not necessarily prevent development and that such urban development was not suitable in this location. As I have mentioned elsewhere, while the option of vesting the open space zone was not precluded, the alternative of securing public access through easements over the land, presumably in gross, was, if anything, the favoured option at the time for cost-saving reasons and in recognition that it was land that was not appropriate for built form and served a valuable public access function. There was certainly, from my recollection, an element of compensation being made in lieu of rezoning those parts of the rural general zone that had the ability to absorb development as low-density residential, which is the majority of the Peninsula Bay land holding at the time. As recorded in the district plan, the open space zone has a purpose of protecting landscape values, natural character, and informal open space to be used for passive recreation, and has objectives of protecting and maintaining natural ecological values and the open appearance and enabling public use of the open space zone for passive or informal recreational activities. I also note the intention from a district-wide perspective was to utilise the open space zone in other parts of the district plan in order to ensure a hard urban edge, public recreational use and landscape protection without the threat of ad hoc lower density clustered or rural residential type typologies encroaching into that land, which was seen as a potential risk under the general zoning. It was one of the alternatives. The ultra-virus nature of the ODP provision. To assist the panel with understanding the ultra-virus nature of the existing ODP role in the district plan, I can advise that the Environment Court's third interim decision, quote the number there, in relation to Plan Change 19 to the Lake Queensland Lakes District Plan made a finding on this matter. In summary, that decision found that the role, which I recall as being similar to that which applies to Peninsula Bay, was ultra-virus because the activity status of consequent consents was then determined by whether it was consistent with an ODP which sat outside the district plan. Since that time, to my knowledge, no other plan change in this district has utilised or sought to carry over those provisions, similar provisions, but rather have used alternative means to achieve similar discretion or control over those sort of bigger picture outcomes. I've not had the opportunity during the course of the hearing to consider how the matter would be best dealt with in this instance. In terms of whether it is necessary to retain the ODP role in respect of the zone, I agree with Ms. Taylor that there are complications, including potentially scope issues, with simply removing it due to the fact that the role relates to the whole of the Peninsula Bay, and there is already an ODP consent involved in this land. Presumably on the face of it, there would be scope for you to specifically exclude the Peninsula Bay North subzone from the role. In response to another query of the panel, I can advise that in my opinion the following matters that are currently captured by the ODP stage but would not be captured by the proposed rules or structure plan if the ODP were to be removed are as follows. You would be limited ability to control landscaping within the road reserves within the Peninsula Bay North Zone, although general matters of control at the time of subdivision do provide for control over the provision for streetscape planting within the road and public spaces. There would be no mechanism for ensuring the appropriate provision of and location of easements for public access purposes throughout the open space zone and their relationship to the low density res zone, and no ability to refuse a consent application that failed to provide such easements or vesting. There would be no ability to recheck the visibility of dwellings from the lake at resource consent stage, and there would be no requirement to provide a statement from the Wanaka Urban Design Panel or a record of the outcomes of a public open day. In my opinion, in order to overcome these gaps created by the removal, if that's what you just decide to do, the removal of the ODP stage, should the panel wish to do so, point A above could be added to the structure plan and the standard imposed requiring a landscape plan to be approved, and I'll discuss that further below. Point B, which is the issue of the vesting or easements, would need to be added to the subdivision rules. Point C is probably unnecessary if the panel is satisfied that the visibility of the dwellings is appropriate. And point D, while potentially, in my mind, perhaps raising various issues, could be added to the structure plan or a rule or a matter of control in terms of subdivision in the area. Response to points raised by legal submissions and other experts. This section covers the following matters. The growth and uses of the reserve land, the vesting of the land as reserve, whether the land is within the current and future urban growth boundaries, the risk consent process following the plan change and what discretion and control that provides, and the adequacy of the provisions and reliance on the structure plan to achieve the desired outcomes. Ms. Semple raises the concern that I state in paragraph 10.9c that of my section 42A report that the plan change will not provide adequate usable land to provide for the rapidly growing number of recreational users, citing correctly that this is not substantiated by Ms. Galavazzi's report. Just to clarify, I rely on the statistics cited in my paragraphs 15.4 and 15.5, and in referring to the rapid growth in recreational use per se as a function of the rapidly increasing tourist and resident population growth and the fact that cycling and walking is becoming increasingly popular as recreational pastimes, I guess, amongst both visitors and resident populations. So Ms. Semple is correct that I've no evidence that the use of this area is rapidly increasing, but rather I draw that conclusion, that all public spaces, when it is vested or easements granted, will rapidly become increasingly well used over time in the wider area. While discussing comments made in relation to these paragraphs of the Section 42A report, I also note for completeness that the economic benefits to Wanaka cited in paragraphs 15.4 and 15.6 of the Section 42A report derive from the MB's monthly regional tourism estimates, which show the annual spend in the Wanaka area to be $399 million for the last 12 months. I also wish to record that I was very clear in my Section 42A report about the difficulties around quantifying the benefits of passive recreational industry to Wanaka, but stand by my overarching conclusions. For the record, despite having an economics major, I confirm that I do not profess to be an expert in economics, but consider it important to highlight the reasonably foreseeable recreational needs of current and future generations and the potential benefits thereof. Ms. Taylor, along with other experts, states numerous times that the land is privately owned, that no public right of access exists over it, and that public access is provided at the liberty of the landowner. This is despite the fact that, as you're now well aware, there has been a condition of consent since 2007 requiring that this be vested in the council and that such vesting may occur in stages. In Ms. Taylor's paragraph 11.21, she contends that Peninsula Bay joint ventures could simply keep the last few lots in the same ownership as the open space land before retaining it in private ownership in perpetuity. Mr. Bodding makes a similar assertion in his evidence. I interpret what they're saying is that the title of Lot X could simply never be obtained and therefore Condition 11 would never need to be fulfilled. While that may be possible, in my view you would need to obtain some legal advice as to whether that is the case, and particularly whether it is in accordance with the condition that this vesting may occur progressively in stages that match the staging of the subdivision. Whether withholding the vesting and not replacing it with easements of such a large piece of land due to one or a few sections not having been titled seems inconsistent with the commensurate intention of the condition in my view. I do agree that through a variation to condition 11 of the ODP consent, the applicant could apply to achieve this end result. However, I note that pursuant to objective 15.136 and the associated policies, objective 20.1.2 and the associated policies and implementation methods, and to rule 7.5.33, small Roman numeral 3, that public easements are clearly anticipated and are a matter of discretion at the ODP stage and would, in my view, be required to be provided through this part of the open space land as part of any variation to the existing condition. I note that the activity status of varying the ODP considers discretionary and a new ODP is restricted discretionary and could therefore be declined. Ms Taylor and other experts state that the site is within both the current and future urban growth boundary. While it is correct that it is within the urban growth boundary shown in the PDP, this document is irrelevant to these proceedings. There is no urban growth boundary in the operative district plan, which is the relevant plan in this case, and while it is within the urban growth boundary shown in the Wanaka structure plan and in the growth management strategy, I believe, neither of those plans or strategies are developed under another act, and therefore is this irrelevant in the consideration of this plan change. I also make the point that there are other less natural but extensive open spaces within the urban growth boundary, as there should be in a well-planned urban area, and as such, in my view, there should be no presumption that all land within the urban growth boundary is therefore necessarily to be developed or suitable for development for urban purposes. With regard to the two-step resource consent process that will follow the plan change if approved, I'm not quite as confident as Ms Taylor that it will necessarily ensure that all of the effects are managed in the manner it's intended and anticipated in the request as evidence. While I concur with much of Ms Taylor's assessment of how the consent process would progress, I note that in relation to planting, A, at the ODP stage, the matters of discretion only relate to planting within road reserves and only to land within the LDR zone. And therefore, that rule does not enable consideration of species composition. And B, at the subdivision stage, the structure plan provides a plant list, but in my view, neither the rule relating to that or the general controlled subdivision rule provide the ability to decline an inappropriate dominance of a certain species, or at the very least, it would be costly and inefficient to attempt to do so. While I agree that the matter of plant spacings, which was discussed as an example at the hearing, earlier in the hearing, I think with Ms Taylor, is a matter of detail that can be left until resource consent stage, I consider that the matter of composition is fundamental to determining the appropriateness of the plan change from a landscape and ecological perspective. In this respect, I agree with Ms Taylor, who in questioning suggested that a standard may be necessary to ensure a management plan and landscaping plan would need to be agreed with council as part of any subdivision in order to overcome this issue. I know there's a precedent for this in the district plan in relation to Ferry Hill Rural Residential Subzone. I also have some concerns that the requester's proposal and its contention that the plan change is appropriate relies solely on the rules in the subdivision section in addition to the general ODP rule in section 7. I note this is largely the result of having dispensed with the land covenant approach in favour of rules at the request of the council and the council's preference not to amend the low density residential zone, and I'm sure there's no intention by the requester to circumvent the rules in any way. However, I am concerned that this may have the unintended consequence of meaning that if the developer were to undertake land use prior to subdivision, then there would be no requirement to adhere to the structure plan or the detailed rules in the subdivision section until the time of subdivision, if and when that occurred. While the rules proposed in the subdivision section certainly intend to capture development as well as subdivision, I suggest the panel may wish to carefully consider whether this will operate as intended if they are of a mind to approve the plan change. And really, there I'm saying the subdivision section really does just relate to subdivision, and normally the development side of things and the land use side of things will be dealt with in the underlying zone provisions. Something that would need to be carefully checked. For the record, I do not consider this to be a fanciful proposition. It's just noting that clustered dwellings on a single title used primarily for visitor accommodation purposes, and the examples I'm thinking of are often located in places or areas such as this. And I just note that I only sort of thought about that implication of the rules during the hearing, which is why I haven't raised it beforehand. It's just something to consider. It's not insurmountable. It's just something to be careful of, I think. With regard to the adequacy of the provisions, in addition to the above comments, I stand by the need to amend them in the manner I've suggested in the version attached to my section 42A report, so that the panel recommend that the plan change be approved. In respect to the provisions, I also note, just simply for completeness, that both the experts seem to agree that prostrate bluegrass and Pushum pomalea should be included in the planting plan, and as such, these will need to be added to the structure plan should the plan change be adopted. Response to the amended proposal. for the purpose of this section, rather than repeat the recent amendments to the proposal, I adopt the summary of the changes proposed by the requester as outlined in paragraph 12 of Ms. Semple's opening legal submissions for the requester. The only exception to this is that I don't believe the bluegrass and Christian Pamelia have yet been added to the structure plan in the manner intended. It's simply a matter of timing, I'm sure. In considering the appropriateness of the amended proposal, I've carefully considered the requester's legal submissions, the written and verbal evidence provided on behalf of the requester, the submissions and evidence of the submitters, and the advice and evidence of the council's experts. In summary, I'm of the view that, considering all of the costs and benefits of the effects of the amended proposal, it remains inappropriate. In saying this, I wish to highlight that it is the cumulative costs on landscape and on amenity and on recreational amenity and on the ecology which have led me to this conclusion. I've accepted the relatively minor and or short-term benefits of the proposal relating to efficient land use, economic benefits and employment, but in the absence of any clearly demonstrated and significant net benefits in relation to recreation, ecology and or the landscape, I cannot support it as being an effective and efficient proposition. While certainly a significant improvement on the notified plan change, nothing in the amended proposal and the evidence has convinced me that the plan change as amended would be the most appropriate way of achieving the objectives of the district plan or part 2 of the Act. The proposed new objective has not been amended and therefore it still does not include as a priority the protection of at least the at-risk native vegetation and does not recognise the natural character of the landscape. As such, it remains inappropriate in my view. I also note the objective only exists in the subdivision section of the district plan and as such arguably cannot be considered when assessing ODP application under section 7 of the district plan. I remain of the view, having considered all three sets of landscape evidence and the questioning of the panel, that the ONL classification should include the whole subject site as preferred by Dr. Reid and Ms. Stevens. I note that all experts, including Mr. SB, accept that the eastern half of the south-facing part of the site is either ONL or at least has character that is very similar to the ONL land. And on this basis, in my view, the land containing at least lots 13 to 26 should be considered an ONL or section 6B landscape. The decision as to the category of the remaining land appears less clear, and while I consider the lots to the west of Bull Ridge and south of the northern ridge line, i.e. lots 1 to 3 and lots 7 to 11 or 7 to 12, may sit outside it. On balance, rather than effectively cutting the north facing slopes of the ridgeline in half, I favour zoning all that area as ONL. That said, I concur with others that the matter of whether the land is or is not ONL is not determinative of whether it is appropriate for rezoning as low density residential. Rather, that classification simply helps to determine the extent to which the plan change relates to a matter of national importance when considering it in terms of the purpose of the Act, or whether the landscape matters in relation to part of the site are subject instead to section 7. I also note that the relevant objectives of the district plan that need to be considered pursuant to section 32 of the Act are the same regardless of the landscape classification. Together, the removal of lots 5 and 6, the reduction in the size of lots 20 to 24 and lots 7 to 12, and in the size of the buildable area of lot 21, the restriction on the colours of some lots, restriction on height of exotic species on lot 4, and lots 20 to 26, the removal of the post and rail fencing, and the fact that the majority of the planting will now be on public land will reduce the overall adverse effects on landscape values. However, in my opinion, the overall costs in terms of landscape combination with others continue to outweigh the benefits. I accept the development of lots 1 to 3 and 7 to 11 would have the least effect of all the proposed lots, as it did with the notified proposal, and that it will have little, if any, effect on ecological and recreational values. However, after careful consideration, I remain of the view that approving the rezoning of these lots would adversely affect visual amenity, the existing sense of place and character, strong sense of containment, and result in a less legible urban boundary. I therefore conclude that the benefits of approving such a plan change would be outweighed by these adverse effects, together with the inefficiencies intrinsic in creating a separate zone or subzone and a complex set of site-specific rules for such a small area. In this sense, it's similar to the three-lot option I consider in Appendix 3 of the Section 42A report. I had not considered the views from the track along the eastern part of the open space zone previously, but have now done so and concur with Ms Stevens that this is an important public view of the ridge and south-facing slopes that should be considered. The amendments made to the recreational amenities being offered are all positive, but I remain of the view that these upgrades or additional facilities are not necessarily desired by the community at this point in time, or at least not to the extent that they would offset the loss in open space zoning. In saying this, I note that it is my view that the council can ensure public access is provided in perpetuity, either through guesting or easements, as intended by the district plan. I'm satisfied on the evidence that protecting and enhancing the at-risk species within this threatened environment should be the focus of any revegetation plan for the area, that any revegetation in this environment will benefit from wild and conifer and rabbit control, and that the existing plant communities should be protected, enhanced and maintained by retaining the current zoning and improving custodial management. While I accept that the amended proposal will achieve more native diversity and a net increase in the area of native vegetation once established, I favour the conclusions of Ms Palmer that the extensive planting proposed is not necessary, will not result in improved ecological outcomes, as articulated by Ms Palmer, and in objective 4.1.41, and that outcomes would be better served and more cost effectively achieved by protecting and enhancing what is already present on the site.
Okay, thanks for that. So you've sort of, through that evidence, you've sort of identified some areas where, the plan change has been proposed. There's some sort of gaps or sort of things that could be addressed to help address the sort of, ODP sort of aspects of it. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's helpful. I guess standing back from that, one question I had, I mean, you mentioned a couple of times about we've got sort of two options in front of us, I guess, in a way, haven't we? We've got three. We've got the request as proposed and modified through the evidence, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The current situation and sort of one in between, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, our job, I guess, is to work out which one is the more appropriate or the better sort of way to achieve the outcome of the act. I mean, it's a subtle difference. I mean, you've referred to the most appropriate, approach. Often these cases, we don't really know what the most appropriate is. The option is ultimately, all we've got in front of us is sort of three options. It's more about which one's the better or the more appropriate option, perhaps, is a better way to look at it. Is that?
Yeah.
You had to see it too?
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, that's a sort of a clarification around wording, I guess. I guess we, in doing that, to a certain extent, we've got to set aside some of the issues or say, well, the issues that have been identified in terms of the plan change, in terms of some of its mechanics, we can address those in one way or another, so we can sort of, get those to a reasonable level. We don't need to really take those sort of factors into account when we're looking at this issue of, the more appropriate or the better option.
The macro issue.
Yeah, the sort of macro issue in terms of, as we say, the sort of cost and benefits of the different outcomes.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's sometimes the only opportunity you have to sort of influence the final form of it, depending on how the commissioners run it, is at the hearing.
Yeah,
so
no,
it's best
I appreciate
to try and get
that.
Some of that on the table.
Yeah. That's right.
Rather than inherit some rules that might not be perfect.
Yeah, just a quick question, I think, and it's probably something that the requester will probably pick up and reply, but I think the introductory comments you made about the reason behind the open space zone and that it provides more protection than the rural general zone, that's probably given strength by the comments that, or the paragraphs that the submission of Forest and Bird referred to yesterday, talking about the concern of Mr Thorne, who was at the time, that there was nothing that would prevent future subdivision of view of the open space owner and the court's view at that time, and accepting that it's not set in stone, but the court's expectation was that the open space zone provisions would be sufficient to prevent that happening.
That's right, and prohibited status for any residential activity, etc. So it was a very high bar, and I think all parties understood that at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
Just what other open space zones have you got?
It's only the only other one is at Riverside, I understand, in Albert Town. And so it hasn't been carried over into some of the other areas. It's usually been considered as part of the cost benefit analysis in other rezonings, such as three parks. But in the other instances, there were other options that were preferred in the end for different reasons. So I believe it's still on the radar in terms of, I was considering it as whether that is, would be the best option in terms of creating an edge to a new special zone or dealing with a particular edge issue.
So, for example, hand-me-downs, there's been no open space zone.
Well, there is, but it already, it's part of the Jack's Point zone, and it already has its own open space zone as part of the special zone. Yeah, so it has a very similar, approach, but it's not prohibited.
Checking the Okay, well, thanks for that and the supplementary evidence there. So, where do we want to go from here? What do we want to do now? Obviously, closing, that's right.
Yes, and I think my colleague yesterday talked a little bit about the prospect of the button unit.
Yeah.
Having had the opportunity to review that information overnight, there's quite a mix of information in what is called supplementary evidence. Some of it is true rebuttal.
Yeah.
But some of it is new. And with respect, I think there's information that could have and perhaps should have been included in the reports that sat with the Section 42.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking specifically there, perhaps the information that Dr. Reid has put in about the position of the ONL.
Yes.
And probably the information that Palmer has included around the heritage and how she's reached the point about what it was that the next site in terms of timing of that, they would have had 5 working days if it had been in. So that might be inappropriate. I'm hesitant to say that because it always is difficult when the witness has been out of the office travelling and we suddenly say, and now you've got 5 working days to respond when actually you've got a backlog of 3 working days of work already. So I'm in your hands as to, but I would like it to be at least 5 working days and then a closing.
Right. We don't want to sort of hurry, we want to get good information, obviously, and good evidence in front of us, so good analysis, so we don't want to sort of, rush that part of it. I mean, and again, I don't think we've got any problem with some sort of form of rebuttal type evidence. I think it's fine. I mean, again, we wouldn't want... Yeah, that's right. And it's not... I mean, obviously, that will go out to the parties, but we won't be expecting any comment from the parties on that evidence. We don't want to get through another round of, you know, comment upon comment. Got to draw the line somewhere. Yeah, that's right. So from the submitter's point of view, there'll be no further opportunity for further response or evidence. So... and again, I mean, I'm 5 week day sounds a bit tight from my own point of view. I mean, a couple of weeks I would have thought would be fine.
I'm sure that 5 weeks is much appreciated.
And the question would be, would the closing come in at the same point?
Well, we could do that, although, of course, I prefer that it's actually just a few days later because, frankly, we need to read that evidence to know.
You shall, okay.
And whilst I can try and witnesses will work to deadlines, as I'm sure you know. So my preference would be that we lodge that, and then some days later we lodge our closing.
Okay.
And that will also provide a short opportunity if there is anything that you suddenly say,
hang on,
you're going to need to address me on this.
Oh, that's a good point.
Then we can include that in the closing.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we're not intention would be intention again wouldn't be to reconvene.
No,
I just receive that on the papers. But there may be some points of clarification or something that may go through.
You might want to issue a memorandum about.
Well, that's a good point. And I mean, I guess over that period of time too, ourselves we'll look over the material. If we think there's any gaps, you know, again, we may need to issue a minute or you know some sort of request for further information, possibly. So that'll allow time for that too, which would be quite helpful. Not uncommon in a plan change situation, as you know, it's offered an iterative sort of situation. Mm. Mm. So I think that sounds like a good. You've got any thoughts, good plan of action? Is that sort of
reasonable.
A couple of weeks, and then I think a week after that. Yeah. So a couple of weeks for the any additional rebuttal evidence.
So that might take us comfortably to the 24th of August.
Yes. In terms of two weeks from today, yeah.
And then through the week after that would be a lovely round number day for the 31st of August.
Sure. Okay.
And unless you want to make it a Friday to avoid working people over the weekends.
Fridays are always good. So we could make it
26th
and the 2nd of September.
Sorry,
26th? 26th for rebuttal and the 2nd of September for closing.
Right. Sounds reasonable to me. Yeah. Great.
And I guess what that offers is if one of the witnesses has some difficulty and can't do it, then you're open to extending it.
Thank you.
Yep, well, that sounds good. Okay, thank you. I guess we should formalise that in a minute. Yeah, I'll probably do that shortly. Yeah, and it can just go out around the parties just as a timeline, and again, that reinforcing that we're not expecting any other comment from submitters or the council staff.
And the only other thing
I'll say
is that you asked for a table yesterday, just splitting out. We've got the first draft of that, but I haven't had an opportunity to read it.
Sure.
So I'd like to look at that before reading
it. Oh, no problem. So, when you're ready, that'd be great. Yeah. Brilliant. Okay. Brilliant. Well, thank you. Thank you for sending the team for the evidence and the presentation was very helpful. Thank you. I think the submitters have left the room, but that was also helpful. And council staff too, thank you for your attendance, the additional information. So we'll adjourn now.